when you're in the adversity, to know that it's going to have a positive outcome, that is really difficult. I think I may have got there with the last couple of things, but no, certainly not in those days. It was hell on earth, and I thought, this is the end.
My guest this week is Paul Hargreaves, the Complete Visionary founder, of course, of Cotswold Fair and Flourish. And although you might not recognise his name immediately, I bet you've eaten some of his speciality foods that he's distributed to delis and farm shops and restaurants and independent retailers up and down the country. But something that got me in this podcast was not only his story that has all of the brilliant ups and downs of an entrepreneurial story full of soul, three moments that he thought he was going to break, but this moment that we connected over what he has written about, the fourth bottom line, and the idea that businesses should be led with founders who understand their heart and their soul. This brought something up for me that was so emotional. And it was just a meeting of minds, but also maybe I thought Paul saw me and understood what I've been trying to champion for the last 20 years. So this is a very personal podcast to me. His vulnerability, his empathy that he shows, the fact that these aren't nice to haves in business, but in life as well. So if you are a founder of a business, or you're someone who just has true values, this is going to be a podcast you absolutely enjoy. I guarantee it.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Paul, firstly, thank you for joining me today. It is such a great opportunity for us to hear your story. Welcome to Conversations of Inspiration.
Thanks for having me. Really now, looking forward to this.
I hear that you are a fan of Conversations of Inspiration.
Yes, I've been, someone got me onto it. I think it was one of your first guests, actually, Ed Perry, because I think he was fairly early on. So he told me about the podcast, and I've been listening to it in the car pretty much ever since.
Well, he was on our first series. So
okay.
You've been listening to it for a while, as long as I've been recording it. So I'm so excited to actually speak to somebody who understands this podcast, understands what we're doing. Mm. But today is all about you now. So you're going to be able to listen to yourself in the car.
Mm. No, I won't do that. No. Well, been on Paul, a few podcasts. I never listen to them.
Well, you're the founder of two incredible companies, the multi-award-winning Cotswold Fair, a specialist food wholesaler, and Flourish, a beautiful food hall and restaurant and lifestyle store, which is opening soon.
Well, what one is open already?
One is open. So
the first one opened in June 21, just at the end of COVID, which was another story we might get onto. And then the second one's opening in November. Well, it's already open, and we took over an existing site, but we've doing a lot of building, and we're opening as Flourish on 6th of November.
And where 24. Is that?
It's about halfway between Bath and Frome, just off the A36.
I can't wait to come and visit. You're a man that's going to inspire so many when you tell your story, and you've dedicated really your life to using your businesses as a force for good and encouraging people to put heart and soul into their business. And so I'm really looking forward to this moment with you. As you know, we start just right at the beginning, the small pool. I want you to go back in time if you can. I love understanding right from the start what influences our guests. And when I researched you grew up in Manchester and you attended Manchester Grammar School and your parents were both doctors and really believed in education. Is that right?
Yes. They were both the first people in their families to go to university. And that was a big deal for them and also their families. The rest of their families always looked up to them somewhat. So they placed a big deal on exams, doing well at school, almost to the detriment of other stuff, actually. So this is some of the reflection I've done since. I think quite a lot of the love I experienced as a child was conditional. It probably wasn't, but I felt like it was conditional on doing well and they would like me rather than loving me unconditionally. Now, as it happens, all three of us did okay in education. So, but yes, I think there was probably a lack of emotional content there quite a lot of the time.
Do you think that's quite a sign of that time, that era, that age, in terms of what they must have experienced when they grew up?
Yes, and I've interestingly, the cousins from my dad's side of the family, we've started getting together every summer. And yeah, we never had these kind of conversations when we were younger, but I've started talking to them about that. It does seem that it was a similar experience for them as well as me.
Absolutely. I think it's such a interesting thing as we go through these generations, how we now are with our children, as you said, this
totally
the absolutely unconditional love. But yet we still hold on to what our own childhoods were like. But with your parents both being doctors, do you think that they instilled this sort of sense of responsibility or a strong work ethic when you were younger? Because I suppose they were highly professional. They were committed to a servicing of other people. Was that in the air that you breathed at home?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, particularly my dad, who was a surgeon, where there's more contact with the actual patients. My mum was an anaesthetist, so more of a science-based job, really. But I think definitely the work ethic was really strong, and probably less so on the service side of it. I'm sure that was there, but it more came through that they were doing what they're doing. They were keen on building up their material possessions. And that seemed, again, this is my perspective, so it may be wrong and I might be doing them a disservice, but they were pleased that they were doing well in the world and certainly enjoyed the fruits of that. So that was probably the main thing I experienced. And I did kind of always realise that I was very privileged in terms of what I had, what I could do, particularly bearing in mind we lived in a nice house in Sale, which is South Manchester, but we were very close to what was at the time the largest council estate in Europe, I think, Withenshaw. So I was always aware, because we drove through that way a lot, I was always aware that we had a lot more than other people did in the same area. And I think I did definitely carry that on into my charity work initially and then into the business later on in life.
Find it really interesting. We're going to get into this because I've met you before and understood that you have done self-reflection in your life. So I'm finding it quite interesting, your answers. But going back to you in this early stage, your parents put a lot of emphasis on your academic achievements and making sure you did well. You did do well. You got biology, chemistry and physics in A-levels. Christ knows how you did that. And you went to Oxford Uni. But instead of following in your parents' footsteps, potentially, which they might have liked, you went into zoology. What drew you into that degree?
Interestingly, they didn't really encourage us to follow in their footsteps. I think both of them at the time we were making those kind of decisions, they were pretty disillusioned with the health service at the time, which probably similar situation to now, actually. This is obviously many, many years ago. But yeah, they certainly didn't encourage us because I think they were a bit cheesed off with it all at that point in their careers. I mean, it was, this is slightly embarrassing, but I did look at the odds on getting into Oxford and ratio of applicants to places, and zoology was one of the easiest subjects to get in on. So I did my research, as you have
I
done,
love
obviously.
Your honesty, yeah.
And yeah, it worked.
And it worked.
Yeah.
And what did you, what happened? Because I did actually, I'm wondering if when I've read these things, you've sort of created a good story. But I did read that you loved bird watching, wading through swamps, that actually nature was important to you.
It definitely had been. And there was a guy at primary school, actually, who took me and another lad under his wing because he was very, very keen on nature, knew absolutely loads. And we were both keen on bird watching when we were kind of 9, 10. So he used to take us on trips out into the countryside, outside Manchester at the weekend. And yeah, definitely that love of nature was already there. And probably fell away from that when I went to secondary school. And then obviously very much come back to it in recent years. But maybe there was an inkling I still wanted to touch into that in my degree. So it wasn't just the ease of getting into Oxford with that degree.
Yeah.
But interestingly, I was there at the same time as Richard Dawkins, who obviously you haven't had him as a guest on the podcast because he's probably one of the most eminent zoologists, certainly at the time and still today. But it was really actually quite depressing because it was all to do with the mechanistic side of evolution and survival of the fittest, and no sense of wonder, no sense of awe, no sense of nature speaking to us. It was all very, very mechanistic and scientific, and actually carried that on into a philosophy for life, which wasn't great either. So
I read you challenged him.
I did, yes, in a lecture. Well, and my memory of this is slightly hazy, but I did stand up and challenge his philosophy on life in a lecture.
Not to take the time when we want to hear your story, but what was his philosophy? What was the sort of nutshell of his philosophy?
Well, it was every man for himself, basically. I mean, that's the logical conclusion of Darwinian evolution, isn't it? And he was, yeah, he didn't come across as a particularly compassionate individual at the time. So, yeah, I challenged him in a lecture. Of course, no one else stood with me. They were too scared of him. But a few people did come up to me afterwards and say thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
I thought, well, maybe you could have done it at the time, it would have been helpful, but yeah.
Seeing as the room was silent when I
tumbleweed, yeah.
But it's quite interesting, we're going to go into now later on after your degree, but I'm already feeling there was a seed growing there, potentially why you stood up, why you felt the need to stand up and say something against that philosophy. I love this bit of your life, because there you are, you've got a degree from Oxford, you know, you come out and it's not wherever you've gone. You spent time driving a lorry, you sold office furniture, you worked in sales before setting up a charity that helped those living in poverty in London. I mean, and then you went into doing something within charity already as quite a young man.
Yes, I think I left gainful employment when I was about 24. So I was employed for 3 years, and actually a nightmare employee, if I'm honest.
Why were you?
Because I was always challenging the status quo.
Right.
Anything that I didn't think was right.
Oh, gosh.
I was totally undiplomatic. I mean, some of this is my northern heritage. Some of it's just being bullshit, I think. Some of it probably is this innate desire that, due to the kind of emotional deficiency of wanting to be recognized and noticed. Mm-hmm. But I was absolutely a real pain in the arse to anyone that was employing me. In fact, I did one of those psychometric tests. It gives you a kind of 3-page report on you, and the last line was basically saying, this man is completely unemployable. So there you go. By that time, I wasn't employed.
No, you weren't.
You
were out of there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was always much happier having more control over what I was doing on a day-to-day basis, I guess.
You moved into building and this charity for those in London?
Based in Southeast London. It was church-based, various different charitable facets of a church and different churches, some church stuff working together, trying to make an impact on the local community. And that's what drew me to it, really. It wasn't just a load of people stuck in a building. Most of the kind of church activities, if you like, were out on the streets, out in people's homes. I spent countless hours pretty much every week for many years in Belmarsh Prison, visiting prisoners there. Quite a few of whom were my neighbours, actually. So I used to go into Belmarsh and people used to be shouting to me through the bars of their cells, "Oi, Paul!" Which got me some street cred with the other workers. But a lot of the criminals in Deptford lived on the same street as me.
And how old were you there?
How old? I was between 25 and 35, I was doing that kind of work, yeah.
Wow. Because, I mean, not long after you were doing this work within the charity, you got married. You were also father for the first time.
Yeah.
You've said things were pretty tough. And I read that you felt burnt out and that in order to help ends meet, you started working at your in-law's meringue business.
I didn't work for them. I basically bought the meringues off them and started selling them to delis in London
subsidised thing. Tell me, was this the moment in your life that led you to Cotswold Fair? I mean, because it sounds like a turning point. And is that where you start connecting the dots, the meringues?
So for a few years at the end of my time doing the charity work, which was quite well funded initially, so the money started drying up and I needed more of it because I had some children to feed. So I started alongside that buying initially the meringues and then a few other products from the Cotswolds, and just literally one day a week selling them to mainly delis in London, the old farm shop around the edge of London, and didn't really intend to do anything else other than that. It was a good way of paying for the phone bill, running the car, heating the house, and that was about it. But it did start growing and it took up more than a day a week. And then the turning point was probably went away on holiday. And do you remember the old-fashioned, you might not actually, younger than me, but the old-fashioned taped answering machines? We had tape.
Yeah.
And came back from holiday, and this tape was full of customers' orders, and then of course they couldn't leave a message. And the later message is, "Well, I left an order a week ago. Nothing's happened." Well, that's because I was on holiday. anyway, so I thought, "Well, this is ridiculous. Can't carry on like this." So, said to myself, "I need to stop or do it properly." And that's I met another guy actually, who, funnily enough, also had been doing charity stuff in Africa. And he was keen to do something with me, and we started properly in 1999. He was good at all the stuff I wasn't good at, which was all the boring bits, the IT, the process, the running the warehouse, etc.
The operations.
Yeah, all the op stuff. And he lived in Reading, and that's why we're still, that wholesale business is still in that area today, because he was doing that stuff. To continue the story, we weren't making any money like many startups. In fact, we were hemorrhaging huge amounts of it, and he couldn't take the pain anymore after a couple of years and basically said, "Over to you." So, that kind of forced me to move out of London closer to Reading.
And so that was the start of it all. And I just want to take a pause in your story because I love the message that your story really sends to young people, the ones who might have an idea of their career path or what they want to do, because I really do believe that life has the ability, and I think you probably have heard it through the podcast, this Conversations of Inspiration, the universe to show us the way. Mm. And for you, it's been your values and have led the way and been part of your business really from the start. And you've come from this charitable side. Yeah. And you knew you wanted your company to make positive impact. And some of your first employees were ex-convicts and recovering drug addicts and alcoholics. And many small businesses and startups, you know, they have good intentions, which actually probably people say are bonkers at the time. You know what I mean? Like, focus on the folk, you know, that's all too much. You need to just concentrate on what you want to do. You've got to make a profit. But to build a business that has strong values and makes positive impact and make it part of the fabric of your DNA of your company, it's difficult, but you've been able to do it. What advice would you give in this pause of your story to them, and how do you incorporate values from the beginning? And I like to think of it sometimes as a fingerprint of our souls.
I'm glad you used the word DNA, so I was just about to use that. And David, who I started it with, absolutely was aligned on those values. In fact, the initiative to employ those people you just mentioned was probably more him than me anyway. So I do think there is something, who understands this stuff, but there is something within a company that is like almost like a founder DNA that remains. Whatever happens in the future, that remains. And, you know, the story continues that I actually fell away from some of that stuff, and then obviously we come back to it big time in the last 10 years. But yeah, that DNA was definitely there. There is a temptation, isn't there, with startups to say, okay, when we're doing well, we'll do some good stuff, we'll do the volunteering, we'll give profits away. But I don't know if that works, because if you start the business where money makes all the decisions, how easy is it to move away from that later in life? It's like people, when, you know, people who in the corporate world say, well, I'm going to, you know, I'll do something useful for society when I retire, almost like it's a kind of chore they have to do. Mm. Well, why not do it now? Because actually that's what gives human beings fulfillment, is by serving others. So why delay? Do it from the start. It will be there within the DNA of the business, and you'll have that to build on later on in the business.
I think when we're building companies, we're so, as you know, and I want to ask you about these first years of building Cotswold Fair, you know, because this epicness, this roller coaster that we're on, this crazy ride that we're on, it's all consuming, isn't it? I mean, it's just so all consuming that all you want to do is be able to survive, pay your mortgages, rents, your life, be able to keep the business going. So this idea of sort of bringing your values in can be a take it or leave it. And it can also be a bit like, well, this is really about me. Is this right? And I think what you're saying here and what I would agree with is it is a fingerprint that stays with the company, whatever happens to the company, you know, so it grows, it's sold, whatever it is. That fingerprint that you put on it, though, I believe is the interesting bit. It makes the business a brand, potentially. It makes the business, you know, I always talk about scratching a brand, and it must bleed through the layers of what you stand for. And that's really, again, you know, if we want to look at it almost from a more business side, that's what people find interesting. That's what makes our heartstring bond from our heart to the business. You know, the emotional commerce is the fingerprint. And so for anyone listening, It is far from not important. It is actually incredibly important that what fingerprint are you going to put on there? What can you come home to? What will always draw you home as a founder? Because it's tough enough loving your business when it's behaving badly, let alone if there's none of your DNA within it.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you would probably give up, wouldn't you? Sometimes if you would be mad not to give up,
no? Yeah. I mean, that would be the thing.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about these early years, because I read that you said for the first 10 years of the business, I was stressed most days and it was pretty tough to stay afloat. Tell me about why that is. I mean, I'm really interested. You were dealing with fresh food. You were dealing with, I mean, God, I can't think of anything worse, actually. Tell me about those first 10 years.
I think the summary of those first 10 years was I didn't really want to be doing what I was doing, which is going to sound really odd, isn't it? But I think because I've kind of almost been forced into business, not, you know, with good motivations, I'd seen in effect that a lot of the charity stuff is just mopping up mess. So far better to be doing something that doesn't create the mess in the first place. And most mess is created by business or government in various guises. So I got that. But I think probably in my heart of hearts, I probably wanted to be doing some relief work in Africa or China or something like that. So I hadn't aligned, I mean, this is the, again, reflection more recently, but I hadn't aligned my personal purpose with the business purpose. So back to your first questions, where I grew up and the privilege and living on the edge of the council estate, I had a fierce sense of injustice and the wrongs of injustice. So deep within me has always been this sense of wanting to reverse injustice. And I hadn't really connected running the business with doing that, despite employing, like you said, an ex-drug addict, ex-alcoholic, and a someone who just come out of Reading Prison. But I hadn't really connected the dots on that somehow. Those first 10 years were, I only half wanted to be there. I hated the business in many ways.
Really?
Didn't enjoy it. It wasn't, I didn't see it as the main thing I should be doing with my life. And now that has totally changed.
But it must have taken every single hour it must have taken everything, no?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, more so then than now, probably. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's not great fun driving a forklift at midnight when everyone else has gone home.
Dell Technologies are passionate champions of small businesses. They recognise that it can be a lonely road, and so they have the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network, or DWEN for short, which is a worldwide community of over 100,000 female founders. They run free events and mentoring programmes and have a network of brilliant women all connecting and sharing insight. They also recognise that for many small businesses, visibility is one of the biggest challenges they face when trying to reach new customers. So each week, Dell give away their ad break space. So now I'm going to hand over to this week's winner of Dell's independent ad break.
Hi, I'm Dr. Naomi, co-founder of the Menopause Company. Menopause, a stage of life so many of us experience, but for too long it's been whispered about, misunderstood and under-supported. Our journey started with one mission, helping women thrive through the perimenopause and beyond, creating a community where every woman feels prepared, informed and empowered. We know the struggle, feeling tired, battling brain fog, wondering how to manage your symptoms without the weight, and often feeling unheard. We're proud to be a small business born from a personal passion and a drive to make a real difference. We offer clear, evidence-based advice and expert consultations to take you from chaos to calm. No more confusion, no more long waits, just the guidance you need when you need it. So whether you're seeking relief, understanding, or just someone who gets it, we've got your back. Follow us on Instagram at The Menopause Company and visit our website at themenopausecompany.co.uk.
Thank you, Dell, for your support and generosity. If you'd like to find out more about Dwen and connect with brilliant and inspiring women, or you'd like to be in with a chance to have your very own ad break here on this series, head to holly.co/Dell. Now, back to this week's conversation of inspiration. So, the first few years, you're thinking, what the hell am I doing? You've got charity burning in your heart, and you're trying to make positive, you know, your positive values shine through in your business. You took your daughter at this time to Kenya, and you were deeply moved by your experience there. You saw people who had absolutely nothing, and it sparked this, of course, I mean, this was your yearning in your heart. It was a deep, deep emotional connection in you. And it sort of unleashed this floodgate of tears. Might you share a little bit of what touched your soul and how that shaped your thinking going forward? And what year was this?
This was 2011.
Okay.
Yeah, so my daughter was 15. In fact, I'm going to see her this weekend. She wasn't particularly easy at that age, to be honest. No. But it was a formative...
Maybe took after her father?
Maybe. Formative experience, and I think it's probably had an impact on what she's done since. But more so me in many ways. I don't think I'd ever been somewhere where people had so little and yet were so happy. It was amazing. And I was totally blown away. I'd never been to Africa before that. And came back to tell everyone about the trip and realized as soon as I started talking about it, I couldn't because I started crying. So anyway, after a couple of weeks, I managed to get some words out. And what was really interesting, and this has been completely formative actually since for the business. So it was not everyone, but quite a good proportion of the company were keen to do something to help. And they were really pleased that they were part of a company that wanted to do something to help in those situations. And one person who only worked for us, I think she worked 3 days a week, she said, in my other 2 days a week, I will also work free of charge and organise our first charity ball, which is what she did. But again, some of this is from hindsight, but looking back to those times, there was definitely more of a spring in people's step in terms of... coming to work, and we're not just doing a job, we're not just selling food, we're not just making money for the shareholder, which was me, but they were doing something more useful with their day-to-day life. So that was, it was a shift. Some people weren't into it, actually, and most of them left a few years later when we had a meltdown, which you probably get onto. But yeah, that was the first time it opened my eyes to say, actually, businesses with purpose attract people to work for them. And, you know, that's probably 100 times more true now than it was back in 2011.
And what did you... So you held this ball. Am I right in thinking you raised £25,000?
Yeah.
And you started a farm in Kenya?
Yes, with the proceeds from the ball, we started a dairy farm, tomato farm, the same farm, but dairy and crops. I don't know much about dairy farming, but I know a bit more than I did before that.
And was this to in aid those around? So was it employing people, local people?
Yes, it did to some degree, but it's the money. So this... centre, it's an orphanage and schools, was totally reliant on money from the local area where I live, actually, in the Cotswolds. So most of the funding came from people sponsoring children. Completely unsustainable, particularly as most of the sponsors were getting on a bit in years and clearly won't be going to be around in 20 years' time. So I was trying to make the whole thing a bit more self-sustainable than... We know we're still happy to raise money for capital projects, but the day-to-day running is much, much better if the money is coming in from their own efforts. And someone gave them some land, and it was massively underused, so we used that land to help them be a bit more self-sufficient. And it worked really, really well. for a few years. But unfortunately, in around 4 or 5 years ago, we had to shut it. And it's purely due to climate change, making it almost impossible to farm what we were doing.
And how long was that then? You'd been helping with this farm?
Yeah, it was running about 5 or 6 years.
Wow, gosh. That sense of doing good, taking yourself away, reigniting or igniting. I mean, it'd been sitting in your heart. Charity had been in your heart the whole time. And bringing that into your business, igniting it in other people's hearts and bringing soul into the company.
Yeah.
It was that a fundamental shift? Were you alive again?
Yes, to some degree, yes. As I said, it put a energy into the company that wasn't there before. And it's been a huge privilege over the years to take people who work for us, and also suppliers, actually. I don't think we've ever had a customer go, but yeah, suppliers and people have been from Cotswold Fair, and they think they're going to help the poor people of Africa, which we do, obviously. But to be honest, I think they've actually helped us more than we've helped them, because people are changed. When they go to the situations like that, they come back changed, just as I was. So that, for me, is one of the biggest privileges, is to take people there and see them change. And I did a trip there early this year. Completely blew me away. I'm going to get emotional here. I'm not careful.
What a gift to give people, actually. Let's go back to your story, because I know that in 2014, is this what you were referring to? You faced a huge challenge when a new IT system nearly took the business down. And you've said that you weren't sure actually the business would survive, but it did. And that must have taken enormous resilience on your behalf. What happened and how did you navigate this? Because this isn't about founders when we wake up going, oh my God, you know, I've got to raise money, I've got to do this. You know, we can get through all of this. No, this was something that basically, it was factually going to take your business down. What happened? Talk to me about the navigation of that. And this was another turning
point. Yes, it was the kind of probably middle turning point of three. So the first being that my first marriage fell apart a few years before that. And then this, which I'll talk into in a minute. And then very soon after that, I ended up with malaria, which obviously I picked up in Africa. So those three big traumatic events, they are, I would absolutely, if I could live it all again, I would say yes, bring it on. Because those, particularly those three and several more since, but they're the occasions, they're the times in your life that changes you, aren't they? And everyone needs those times to understand themselves and to grow as a human being. And so I wouldn't be without them. But yeah, I mean, the business was, I won't go into the boring details of the warehouse management system, but basically it was a poor installation. A lot of our stock was in the warehouse, but not being sent to customers because the computer didn't know it was there. So it wasn't being picked. So we'd basically gone from a paper-based system to a picking gun, and unless the computer knows it's there and where it is, it won't get picked. Yeah, it was absolutely traumatic. I think we probably were within about 3 or 4 weeks of disappearing off the face of the planet. And what I did, on the advice of a couple of other directors at the time, was disappear, go on holiday. It was a strange thing to do, but no, I was no use at all. I was running around like a headless chicken, absolutely being no use whatsoever, pretty much there all the time. And I said, we planned this trip, Route 66 trip in America with three of my kids. And I actually rang them 3 days before we were due to go to say, sorry, with this holiday of a lifetime that we've been planning for probably about 8 months, we're going to have to cancel, I'm afraid. Of course, lots of tears from me and them. But then I talked to the other leaders in the business at the time, and they said, actually, why don't you go? You're not actually being that helpful. We'll try and sort it when you're away.
Probably causing more stress.
When I go away, I never communicate back with the office. This holiday, I was on the phone every day. Has it got better? No. Has it got better? No. Every day. It didn't get any better while I was away. Probably got slightly worse. But first day back in the office, I think we were away 2.5 weeks. First day back, sat at my desk, opened up the software, and within an hour, I saw where the problem was with the software in the terms of how it was set up. And that was the start of pulling it back together. It was one setting that needed changing. And I never would have seen, if I hadn't been out of the business for those 2.5 weeks, I would not have seen that.
Yeah.
And that was, it was goodness. A long road to recovery. Probably took 3 months, but that was the start of the recovery, was that my first day back after that holiday.
I read founders having a break there. Let's just make a little note to everybody. I read that you said, I guess one of the keys of weathering and storms and having resilience is the reaction of those difficult times is not that the pain isn't there or that the desperation or the tears aren't there, but it's a sense of knowing that we will come out of this stronger the other side.
No.
Did you really feel like that?
No. And I probably have been more like that in the last few years, but that is really hard when you're in the adversity to know that it's going to have a positive outcome. That is really difficult. I think I may have got there with the last couple of things, but no, certainly not in those days. It was hell on earth. And I thought, you know, this is the end. And I never, the big thing for me, I'd never failed apart from my first driving test. So having a failed marriage, a nearly failed business, and then health failure was, I think men are particularly bad at this, about thinking they're invincible. I certainly was. And those three incidents have helped me learn my vulnerability and learn my lack of immortality and learn that actually I'm not probably as good as I thought I was.
Tell me about that third time of your vulnerability, the malaria.
Yeah, well, I got married by then. Got married about 3 months after the trauma of the business nearly disappearing. Moved house, more trauma. And then we had one honeymoon with Nicola. We went to Norway with the second half of the honeymoon. We'll have a hot honeymoon. Went to Jamaica. And I started feeling really ill. This is about 2 months after a trip to Kenya. Started feeling really ill in Jamaica. Of course, they don't have malaria there, so they didn't diagnose it. Got iller and iller as the holiday went on. Managed to get home. I don't know how that happened. Went straight to the doctors. They didn't diagnose it. And the next morning, I was completely delirious and being blue-lighted to Swindon Hospital, and have very little recollection of the next 2 or 3 days. In fact, my children,
my goodness,
came. So I think it's 2 or 3 of them and my sister came to visit, and I've got no recollection of them being there at all.
So this was a very serious situation that you were in. I mean, tell me about what the prognosis was. I mean, when did they realise you actually had malaria?
Well, they diagnosed it, surprisingly. I don't think they get many cases
in Swindon Hospital.
But they diagnosed it really quickly, but then they didn't know how to treat it. So they were basically treating me in the World War II method of pumping me full of quinine.
Right.
Which is what they used to do in the war, apparently, when people got it. Put me off gin and tonic for a very long time afterwards. But that's the fever tree.
Yes, you know,
the brand fever tree. The fever tree is the quinine tree, which is in tonic water. And that was the way that people got cured. didn't work. I got transferred to the Oxford Tropical Medicine Hospital, and they did sort me out fairly quickly once I got there.
My goodness me. And that was this third, I mean, the run you had at that point in time, did you look at that after your malaria and think, is the world operating against, like, you'd had the marriage, you'd had this basically nearly losing your marriage, losing your business, maybe losing your life. Did that wake up something within you?
I don't know if I've really thought. I don't know. That's a good question. I haven't thought about that. No, I don't think I did. I think there was a sense that deep within me subconsciously that, okay, this is it. This is mm-hmm. life. And maybe there was a sense deep within that I would come through. I don't know. It didn't feel like it at the time, but I didn't feel like the gods were against me or anything like that. I don't really think like that. I think to some degree, your choices make your circumstances, and not the malaria. I did take my malaria tablets. I don't know how that happened, but certainly with the marriage breakdown, the business, it was largely due to some bad choices I'd made in the relationship, and bad choices I made in terms of who we had employed up to that point. It was human failure, not anything external.
I love your reflections. You've obviously done some real reflecting in your life, and it's really, really beautiful to hear. And I think it's one of the best things, I think, that's coming with age, that I'm realizing that I was talking to someone last night, and they were starting their journey of being an entrepreneur, and they were like 25 or something. I was thinking, not all the money in all the world, I would be going back there, because it's quite profound at the moment. You know, it's quite every moment is sort of an ability to reflect on the past, have some peace with yourself, understand who you are, and look back at those things. And I know that our conversations that we've had relatively briefly have very much been around that. I'm going to come back to your story, but as a person, do you feel that you're at a wonderful moment of reflection in your life?
I think a lot of people are when they're in their second half of life. I mean, I don't think there are any shortcuts. This is the thing. The first half of life is all about making mistakes, losing the kind of shadow side of you, the ego. I think when you get beyond the half, I mean, the midlife crisis scenario is part of this for some people, but when you get past that halfway point, I think you do more reflective. You know, there is more wisdom there, isn't there? But I do a bit of mentoring with some of the younger people in our business. In some way, I can help them to some degree, but to some degree, I can't help them because they've got to go through some of this stuff themselves. So you think, well, should I tell them about it or not? But we have to fail, don't we?
Absolutely.
It's through the failures that we learn.
I think it's almost like being a parent. You desperately want, obviously, your children not to feel pain. And yet I reflect on my own life, and as you said, the 20s and the 30s, and there's pain going through that period of time. And same with small businesses that I try and help, and so want to give them, you know, as much as I can every day, every tip, anything I know, anything or connections I can make for people to try and navigate those storms and make better decisions than I did. But at the same time, you've got to go through it. You've got to go through it and have the grazes and be able to heal from the grazes to become the entrepreneur and the person that you need to be. Without them, we don't have, you know, the toughness, the resilience, that what you can then cope with. And many people, and I'm sure yourself, you know, literally say, I don't know how you do it, go through it all. And I'm almost like, well, it's now completely second nature. I mean, this is where my tough skin has been created now. You know, that's because I've gone through it. And so I'm able to maybe achieve things. I've not hit 50 yet, but, you know, I'm at that point though. I'm going to be able to achieve things thanks to what I went through in this second part of the life, which maybe I have more wisdom. I'm going to be able to do even more than I did before.
But that's the beautiful thing about it, isn't it? It's those unique experiences and our own unique reactions to them that makes us the unique person that can achieve something unique in the world. There is no one else like Holly Tucker. There's no one else like Paul Hargreaves because of the experiences we've been through, and the pain is part of that. And that, for me, is the really exciting thing. So it means that no one else can actually do the things I'm going to do in the future because of the experiences I've had in the past. I mean, when you sit and reflect on that, if everyone did that, I think we'd have an amazingly different world, wouldn't we? Because it would bring in that sense of unique purpose, and people would push towards it more than they do without realising that.
I want to go into 2015. Cotswolds Fair was one of the launch cohorts of about 40 B Corps in the UK, becoming part of a movement that I'm lucky enough to now be part of to make the world this better place. And you're now the UK's leading carbon neutral wholesaler of speciality foods to independent retailers. You've been a driving force in your industry. And I remember speaking to our friend Edward Perry quite a few years ago when he spoke about Cook becoming the B Corp, and it was such a small number of businesses that were certified at that time. I think his brother actually brought it over into the UK.
Right.
And I think I'm right in saying there's now around 2,000 B Corps in the UK, and you're a B Corp ambassador. Tell me about the positive impact of becoming a business and what the knock-on effects have been.
Yeah, it was actually Ed that told me about B Corp in the first, second in the UK. And I think in 2013, 2014, he told me about this thing called B Corp. I thought my first reaction was, this sounds a bit American, Ed, what are you up to? but the more I looked into it, the more I was, this is everything I ever believed about business. And I thought I was the only one.
The mad scientist.
And here are all these other people. Yeah, here are all these other people at the time, largely in America and Canada. But not only are they passionate about doing the right thing, they've actually got bloody successful businesses as well. So they're making more profits, but doing it in an incredibly good way. So massively inspiring. I mean, it's been great. I mean, we've got over 80 B Corp suppliers now.
Amazing.
So to give you an idea of the growth of the movement, I think we had 6 in 2020. At the start of COVID, we had 6, and we've now got over 80. And that, you know, there's, like you say, there's almost a sense if you are a startup, you almost, there is a kind of pressure now to go through the certification to be a B Corp. And so in terms of what has it done for us, I mean, now probably more recently, only really in the last few years, we are getting business because we're a B Corp, but that's obviously not the reason for doing it. And certainly wasn't true for the first 5 or 6 years of being one. But it was massively helpful in terms of helping us understand who we were a lot more clearly, helping us communicate to the people that work for us, this is what we're about, and doing it's been really helpful in be able to do that in a way that they understand. It took a while, and initially all driven by me, then a bit later the rest of the leadership team driving it forward, but more recently it's been the other people in the business coming up with all the ideas and the initiatives to be better. It's been coming from them, and I think that's the indication of whether it's really impregnated into that DNA we were talking about earlier is when the ideas are coming from not the leadership team, not the managers, but just the people. Right, this, we could do this better. Let's do it this way. And obviously you need the culture where they've got the permission to do that.
Tell me about some of the controversy that surrounds B Corp in recent years, because I've got to think that any establishment or anything trying to do something like B Corp, you know, the actual putting it through, you're going to have a few of these cases. But what's your viewpoint on that?
There's always going to be some, when a movement grows, there's always going to be some bandwagon jumpers. And yes, it's annoying, but the fact of the matter is most people aren't like that, and the whole thing's moving forward. So we should just be very pleased about that. But there is a danger for the movement. There is a danger. I think it becomes like an ISO, you know, it purely a kind of mind thing, if you know what I mean. I think the companies that, such as BrewDog, it was only ever that. I don't think it had impregnated mm-hmm. into the culture. So I think the danger for the movement is it becomes this list of, you can get into the old way of doing things with a better intention. So it becomes this KPI orientated way of doing things without the heart and soul that yes. has to go alongside it. If we really are going to reverse climate change, it's not just going to be done from mind. It's not just going to be done from scientists. It's going to be done because there are people who are compassionate about people mm. dying in the world, who are compassionate about animals, you know, not having any habitats anymore. And it can't just be a mind thing. So that's the main thing I'm saying currently about the B Corp movement. Yes, fantastic. Love the movement. I love that we've had a role in that. But if it's going to go from strength to strength, it's got to impregnate into people's hearts and into people's souls. And it can't just be a list of things that you've yeah. got to do. It won't work. We'll run out of energy and it'll all burn out.
Yeah, absolutely. And why B Corp have got to keep the ability to get it in the first place and recertify difficult, right? Because we've got to, all of us have just got to yeah. keep proving that yeah. we're the founders who yeah. actually mean it. And it's not yeah. a tick box exercise. When I spoke to Mark Shaler on this podcast, he said, doing good is no longer a luxury or a nice to have. It's a complete necessity. And you wrote so brilliantly about this in your book, Force for Good, Creating a Better World Through Purpose-Driven Business. And you described a new generation of businesses that are emerging, that are working together to make this positive impact on the world and redefining, so important, redefining what we see on bloody Dragon's Den or The Apprentice, you know, what it means that we slightly, it's like sugar. We're just getting fed this stuff on TV, which just, it feels like we're sort of going back into the dark ages when we watch those programs. Needs to be a new business program, just putting it out there yes. to anyone listening. Redefining what it means to be successful. Do you think that people's buying habits have changed and are still changing? And how big a role do you think COVID played in helping people recognize to do things differently? I mean, I talk from my point of view where I know that, I mean, obviously I'm not talking about everybody who had a terrible time in their businesses during COVID. I'm just, in this question, I'm using it as an example of, I know so many people who consciously purchased through that period of time because they just had a little yeah. bit more time to think about where they were voting with their money.
Yeah. I mean, Mary Portas talked about this at the conference this week, that the say do gap.
Yes, what a great phrase.
The saying is increased and probably the doing is a bit more, but there is this huge gap between people saying they want to do the right thing and actually doing it. Now, there's a huge issue here because from an environmental point of view, those kind of products do generally cost more, certainly in the food world they do and in other areas. And it's integrally linked with the social side of things. So, you know, most people in the UK can't buy the good quality food we sell, which is a shame. I mean, you know, we've got to face the facts that we're in effect supplying the kind of top 10% of the population. So we're never going to sort this out until there's this systemic change that means that there is, you know, there is the ability to buy the good quality products that aren't damaging the planet at the same time. So it's a huge issue. We're not going to solve it this morning, are we? There's got to be legislation at some point. I can't see it really. I can't see the dial completely shifting unless there is, if I'm honest.
And do you think, though, generally, when you look at B Corp, though, just generally looking at outside of your business, you must believe that there is a big shift coming through in terms of the spending or the share of wallet going towards businesses that are making more positive impact?
There is a shift for sure, but I don't know if it's going quickly enough to get us out of the hole we're in. In fact, there was a massive, you mentioned COVID, there was a massive shift, I think, in that, certainly that first year of COVID, but I've seen data since that some of that has gone backwards since.
Oh, yeah.
And cost of living crisis obviously plays into that. So yes, things are moving forward, and we should. It's a very. I'm always torn between frustration and being thankful for what's happened so far, and it's a fine line to travel, isn't it? But I don't think things are changing fast enough. Certainly for the climate change side, and inequality is far worse now than it was at the start of COVID. And we're feeding into it because we're still buying the Apple products. We're still, we're still shopping on Amazon, and those two companies aren't best for the world. But we still do it because we're in a system. It feels like we almost have to.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Is it about handmade items that just feel so soulful? Is it the fact that they're made to last, I wonder, and better for the planet? Or that you know someone has poured all they've got into creating them? Or maybe it's that you know they are one of a kind and not mass-produced. Because that's our passion at Holly & Co. Our marketplace is an emporium of over 20,000 unique finds, all touched by hand. And I've brought together a whole community of artists and makers who champion quality, sustainability, and purpose. These founders, or as we call them at Holly & Co., our co's, each have the special touch of magic that brings something unique so that you can shop with pride, knowing you're supporting UK craftspeople and celebrating originality. It also means that the incredible gifts or homeware you buy has a story behind each piece. Every item is made with care and meaning. And what could be lovelier than that? Find us at holly.co. But now, back to our conversation of inspiration. Tell me about your, and what made you do this? In 2021, just after the first lockdown, you launched Flourish, a positive impact, planet-friendly food hall and kitchen. Why did you want to do something else?
It's a good question. Why on earth? Why do you want to get into a hospitality business?
Yes, that's particularly, you mean, at least I'm doing the same thing again, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to do it better.
Yeah.
But you've gone into hospitality, which you couldn't pay me to go back into.
Yeah, the retail side, I kind of probably think certainly with that, I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of independent food retail for many years. So I thought we can actually do this. Take it all the good ideas I've seen elsewhere and not doing the bad ideas. We can do this really well. I mean, it was, the MD of Flourish is massively experienced, an absolute legend. And he really is the mastermind behind all this. And he has massive experience of both retail and hospitality. But the hospitality side was a complete eye-opener. Why did we want to do it? Well, it was an opportunity that was meant to be done by a group of farmers. They fell out. I got approached. And our first Flourish site is on a, people call it a farm shop. We don't, because it's on a farm, but it's not a working farm. So I think that word farm shop should be reserved for working farms, but we call it a food hall and kitchen.
Where is it?
It's pretty much exactly halfway between Bath and Bristol on the A4.
Yes.
So it's on a really busy road, which is great because you've got lots of passing customers. It's in a kind of semi-rural environment and good local demographic. So it was a bit of a no-brainer. And I get bored by doing the same thing. Again, I like new projects. And I was interested to do it. So obviously Cotswold Fair has grown in our B Corp journey and our sustainability journey. I was really interested to start something new again and put in all the stuff right at the beginning I've learned in the previous 20 years. So that was a fantastic project. So we recruited 50 people during COVID, interviewing them in an absolutely freezing porter cabin on a building site, and could hand pick the people that we wanted to work for this new business. What a privilege. And because, as I mentioned earlier, we got a lot better at articulating what we're about, we attracted in the right people to come and work for us. And the vast majority of them are still there. And it's also because our main business is B2B, you know, the sales team are out and about seeing customers. But in terms of the most people who work for Cotswold Fair, in effect, are sitting in front of a computer all day. There's not that human interaction on a day-to-day basis. So to have a business where it is all human interaction, you're delivering food to people's tables, you're serving them in the shop, there's very few people sitting in an office at Flourish. And our values are much more clearly expressed in the B2C business, which was really, really interesting. In fact, my children came soon after we were open. In fact, they've been involved in the business when picking stuff in the warehouse, doing work experience.
They were
in the
brought
office.
Up.
Yeah, yes. And they came for lunch at Flourish, and it was like their eyes were opened. They said, "Ah, Dad, people are really happy here, aren't they?" I said, "Yes, finally, you've got what I've been trying to do all these years."
It was a manifestation of, isn't it? It's bringing, as you said, bringing it to life, actually seeing people, because you have been in the other realm, haven't you, for most of your career. And what an amazing thing. And as we said at the beginning of this podcast, in November, you're opening up your second.
Yep.
I wanted to, before we come to the end of the classic end of this podcast, which you know about, tell me, you've written your first book, but then that wasn't enough. And, you know, when we started this podcast, I bet you people were listening thinking, where's this going? You know, Holly, you're talking about the seed of this guy that wants to do good, but I don't know. I don't. Now we're coming through this podcast and everyone is nodding their head, because it's like as the years go on, you're becoming more maybe who you were always meant to be. I don't know. The thing that was burning inside of you is becoming more obvious to all of us. You're becoming more open with your soul. And you've written another book called The Fourth Bottom Line, Flourishing in an Era of Compassionate Leadership. And for those of listening to this podcast, we probably, you know, are very aware, and we talk about it often on this podcast, the triple bottom line, people, planet, and profit. But tell me about the fourth bottom line.
Well, it was towards probably the end of writing the first book, Forces for Good. Just soon after that, I went on a spiritual walk in India. And I kind of realized, if we really are going to change the world, actually, we need to change as well. So that's what I call the fourth bottom line. It's the, if you want another P, personal change in us. And we can't do it. There isn't a way of doing it unless we become more compassionate, we become more vulnerable, we become more courageous. And the book is 50 characteristics of good leaders, really. And there are a lot of bad leaders in the world. And this was noticeable at the start of COVID. So that's when I wrote the book, in the first lockdown. What we have in our head when we think of leadership, I think in many cases is completely wrong. We don't have the kind of compassionate leaders that we should be. So I wanted to encourage other leaders, including myself, to have love, really. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. It's the love that we need to be good leaders needs to be more manifest in us. And that's what I call the fourth bottom line.
What an amazing thing you've done there. I mean, just incredible. I wonder, and actually this week I heard someone talking about, I don't know who I would be without this business. And what he was referring to was he has the self-discovery, the journey that he has taken through potentially going through very difficult times, overcoming adversity, bringing people along with you, you know, all these opposites and how the ability to grow through what we go through is incredible. And that's great if you're open to this. It brings me such hope. People like you exist. You've written this book. And actually, you as a man have written this book, you know, because myself as a woman, you know, we're not tarnished is the wrong word. I'm very, very proud of it. But, you know, I talk a lot about when I was at Not on the High Street and people used to say that I was far too emotional and I was infectious. I had made everybody too emotional. And I remember feeling, and this is someone that used to work for me, a very senior person. And I remember as the CEO feeling like a child because I remember being called emotional when I was a girl. And this thing triggered me into believing that I had infected the business, because we're all battling with the imposter syndrome, even though I can't stand that. We're battling with our demons all the time anyway, when we're in a position where we've created something out of our imaginations and we didn't swallow the business encyclopedia. So for me, that was just this moment. And all I did at that point in time was try and change. I remember all I tried to do was become a CEO, a chairwoman. And I was becoming more and more what people would consider to be a tech entrepreneur, because obviously I was very few women were there. And I remember that so much. And what I'm trying to do now, and I still battle with it, you know, I still battled with it when I try and raise money and in my VC situations and all these sorts of things, is that what I should have turned around and said to that person. Yeah. I mean, I should have sworn to start with. Yeah. But I should have said, you're only sitting here because I was emotional. You're only sitting here because I've built a business based on emotional commerce, where 35,000 decisions that we make every day, 95% of them are emotional. And actually, that is our USP. And if you can't handle that because you basically don't have an emotion, you best you leave this company. I wish I could have told my younger self to say that. That is what I preach. That is how I live. But to hear you as a man writing a book like that, it's really, really validating for me.
We often get emotional at our leadership meetings. And obviously, I've given the permission for that to happen. But I can remember a number of times there's been too much crying going on to carry on with the meeting. We've had to break and come back, because we can't make decisions just from our mind. It's the best decisions we make are based on the combination of the emotional side, the heart side, whatever you want to call it. Yes, of course, you use your mind as well. But if it was just the mind, goodness me, we're probably why we ended up in a mess. But my dad actually told me when I was a kid to stop crying. Because I was crying outside the gate when he got home from work because I'd broken a window. I didn't cry again for 30 years. So that turned the tap off. And I've probably made up for it in the last few years. But we need more of the feminine in our businesses. And that's really one of my main aims of writing that book. And with the feminine, I don't mean women. We need women, but we need men who are expressing their feminine side as well.
We've come to the end of the podcast where I'm going to ask you about the roller coaster, and you've certainly been on one heck of a roller coaster. What would you say? I mean, you've got a number to pick from. What would you say has been one of your biggest lows?
I think the low would be the 2014, probably about halfway through that Route 66 trip, and I was made the phone call to the office, and I was told basically things were worse than they were when I left. And I did seriously think at that point I would be coming back to no business.
When you say no business, obviously we talk about, was your identity in your business as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes. And then I think that's why people, especially people like me, have to experience failure, because yes, too much of my identity was in my position as CEO of this business, and not enough as Paul Hargreaves, the human being. First thing we ask people when we meet them quite often is, what do you do? So that, like, their identity is in what they do. So I mean, it really kind of annoys some people, but if I'm in a networking thing, I quite often say, who are you? And they quite often answer with what they do.
Of course. But,
it's a much better question, isn't it? It's a Western disease that our identity is in what we do. And I think if I was to sum up my journey in the last few years, I was most of my life as a leader, as a person, I've been doing leader. The last few years I've learned to be, and I probably do less, a lot less, but I achieve more. And it's because I've learned to be a human being. We're not human doings, are we?
Oh my goodness, I'm going to have to really think about that one. I'm not going to like what I think about. Conversely, tell me about your greatest high. What's Paul's greatest high?
Paul, lots of personal ones, so let's leave them aside. But obviously children, wife, but sticking to the business side, probably the day that the first Flourish opened, actually.
Really?
Yeah, it was in June 21. We'd been through 15 months of lockdown, building a new building in a pandemic. Wasn't great fun. And we opened, the day we opened, I'd mainly be focused on the retail side and Paul mainly on the hospitality side, because I'm no good at that at all. And so I came in the day we were due to have this VIP opening evening. And in the middle of the restaurant, there were four toilets. I hadn't been in there for a couple of days. So surely these should be plumbed in. We're opening tonight. Anyway, they were put out of harm's way, and there was one loo there when we opened. But yes, it was a massive team effort to get that place open, and we weren't ready when we opened. We didn't have anywhere near enough people because we had. People were desperate to get out. There was a queue outside the door on the first day. We did no marketing, but people were, you know what it was like at the end of the lockdown? People were desperate to get out, weren't
they? Let us out.
And, So that would be the highlight, yeah.
We're at that point, Paul, where I'm going to ask you, you've shared so much of your soul with us today. You've shared so much of your soul within your books as well. And I would love to hear what you would say to your younger self, and I'm now going to hand over to Paul.
Right, get my spectacles on. I'll try and hold it together during this.
As right, you know, so you said this, to me,
on the
it's
envelope,
very hard for me to hold it together.
I don't expect you to. On the envelope, there's a message that says, "This is to be opened on the bus on your first day of secondary school." So that's the age I'm writing to myself. So here we go. Dear Paul, aged 11 and a half. As you walk down the long school driveway later this morning, there'll be one thing on your mind. Will others accept me and like me when they meet me for the first time? These are the same thoughts as many other students, I'm sure. But the first thing I want to say to you is that it is far more important that you learn to accept and love yourself. This will be a lesson you will spend many decades learning. Due to the high value placed on achievements and results at home and school, there is a danger you'll spend much of your life craving recognition and approval. Do yourself a favour and stop worrying about what others think of you and focus on your own unique purpose in life. Learn to be content as you are, following your own heart and purpose. And don't be so desperate for the praise and recognition from others. Don't worry about what they're up to. There is a unique path for you, as there is for everyone. You've been taught at home and also bombarded by the prevailing culture that achievements are far more important than relationships. They aren't. Compassion and love for others are the most important in life, and it is these that will bear the greatest fruit. You will learn that your family background isn't normal. There is far more love and emotional connection in other families than you've experienced in yours. Your emotional deficit may result in you going into relationships that aren't good for you or for them. Unfortunately, your all-boys grammar school won't help you develop the right relationship with women and girls either. But you will learn to embrace and love the beauty of the feminine and build these feminine qualities into yourself. You'll be able to help other men and women find fulfillment. The best leaders are those who live in the yin and yang of the masculine and feminine in complete harmony. On the emotional side, your experiences will mean that you go from not crying at all for nearly 30 years to crying all too frequently, sometimes on stage in front of hundreds of people. Embarrassing in one way, but it's important for others to see your heart. Talking of leadership, you will discover that this is one of your callings. You've already been the captain of sports teams and will continue to be the leader of teams throughout your life, although never the best player. You will learn aspects of leading through this. But this kind of leadership is only one type. Be aware that more mature leadership is less shouty than being the team captain. Remember your love of nature. Your primary school teacher, Mike Clark, has inspired you in this. But it'll be easy to forget this within the smoke of the city of Manchester. You'll learn later in life that nature can be your greatest teacher. Don't take decades to come back to this first love. You may learn at school about Socrates, who said, "Know thyself." If ever there was one lesson worth learning early, it is this. In fact, self-awareness is the heart of true spirituality. You will encounter other dogmatic forms of spirituality that teach that the answers are only out there. Some are, but true life is found in knowing the Creator's life force within you. Many spend their lives looking for lazy solutions, formulae for living, and rules to live by, but neglect the God love force within them. Know yourself. The mystics have learned this lesson. You'll meet a few of them throughout your life, who you will recognise as living on a different level to other humans and having faces that shine with love. Spend time with these elders and learn from them, and one day you may be more mystical yourself. Fulfillment in life is found within, not without. When possible, immerse yourself in other cultures. Don't wait until midlife to understand the wisdom of India, Asia, and Africa. There is so much depth and ancient knowledge in these so-called underdeveloped countries and cultures that you will help bring to the over-intellectualized and disconnected cultures of the West. Be aware of your anger. Some of this comes from the emotional dysfunctionality I mentioned earlier and needs to be healed. Although not until after a few fights in your first year at this school, none of which you win. But there is a positive side to your anger too. You have a passion for justice and hate the social injustice you've already noticed living close to the edge of a large council estate. You'll become more aware of this and angrier about it. Channel this anger in the right direction and you'll help your life's purpose of reversing injustice. There is one basic life lesson you haven't learnt yet and won't for several years. Shit happens. It's unavoidable and part of everyone's life. Your future failures, relationship breakdowns, and serious health issues are part of life's tapestry. The key to growth in life, though, is to embrace adversity, difficult as that may be. The changes within you that trauma brings are always for the best, and growth and maturity come through these seemingly negative experiences. Those who've been through the most pain are often the wounded healers bringing life to others. Now, you may already have an inkling that you are a maverick and don't like conforming to the world around you. In fact, you will learn later in life that you are virtually unemployable due to your tendency to call out stuff that is wrong. Don't worry about this too much, as it will lead you down your own path of creativity in both charities and business. Don't neglect your maverick tendencies. You are naturally a risk taker, but sometimes others and sometimes your own doubts may hold you back. Don't let them. Your greatest sense of being in flow will come when you take risks. Not all your endeavours will succeed, but even the ones that don't will help you learn for the future. If you do end up in business, here are a few tips. Go with your heart and gut with all your decisions. Take on better people than you think you can afford. They always pay for themselves. Don't be hesitant to part with those whom the company has outgrown. Learn what it is to run a business from a place of abundance. Most businesses are run from scarcity. Be different, be generous. Give to your people, your community, nature, and the environment, and it will be given back to you in profits to do more in the future. putting people and planet first really does lead to better profits. Finally, when things go well, remember that being is more important than doing. It will take you many years to learn this, but by doing less and spending more time in silence and solitude, you will achieve more than in your natural modus operandi, running around like a headless chicken. Now, it's time to get off the bus. Take your bag and walk down that school drive with your head held high, ready for all that life will throw at you. Live well and do good. If you remember one thing from this letter, remember this. Love will conquer all. Paul, age 50-something. Almost made it. I knew that last sentence was going to get me.
Just beautiful. And I think about those who have been brought up potentially with a lack of emotion as a child. And I know quite a few of them, and what that does to the soul as you're moving forward. And one of the things when you just said that to your younger self, it's so beautiful because I can see a man that did travel that path and how much work you've done yourself to bring you back to show love to yourself and love to us. And I'm so privileged to have spoken to you and for you to have brought that love to us today. And if I can be one of those shiny faces who's now crying back to you, full of love for you and what you're doing, let me be that. And I thank you, Paul, so much for your soul with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And it's, you know, it's, I don't know you that well, but you are a soul person. And that was very obvious when I first met you. It comes through the podcast very, very clearly. And you've helped probably far more people than you think you have in terms of finding their hearts and finding their soul. So keep up the good work. It's been a privilege to be your guest.
Thank you, Paul, so much. Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.